Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Deliberate plane crash to have lasting effect on industry. Indications that the co-pilot of a Germanwings flight deliberately brought down the plane en route from Barcelona to Dusseldorf Tuesday could have an impact on the airline industry. The crash investigation now focuses on the co-pilot's possible motives for destroying the aircraft and killing 150 people. Zlatica Hoke has this story.
Flight recordings indicate that Lubitz most likely locked the pilot out of the cockpit before deliberately ramming the aircraft into a mountain. The investigation so far has revealed that Lubitz had a period of depression, which forced him to take a six-month break from flight training. Before resuming the training, he passed physical and psychological tests. Experts say that crash makes it clear the procedures are inadequate.
The aptitude tests will have to be revised. The psychological part will have to be extended massively.
German aviation expert Harald Stocker says a deliberate plane crash will affect the commercial airline industry as profoundly as the September 11 terrorist attacks did in 2001. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Al-Shabaab militants are claiming responsibility for an attack on a major hotel in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, that killed at least five people. Witnesses say Friday's attack against the Maka al-Marakurama Hotel began when a bomb exploded, followed by at least three gunmen storming the building. Guri Haji Hassan is co-owner and manager of the hotel. He tells VOA the gunmen entered the facility through the back door after detonating the bomb. This is VOA News. Fighter jets are striking rebel targets in Yemen for a second consecutive day as part of a Saudi Arabia-led regional effort to oust the Shiite Houthi group that has taken over much of that country. Coalition warplanes pounded military bases and other rebel-held targets in and around the capital, Sana'a, Friday, according to officials and witnesses. Military officials also said airstrikes targeted the northern province of Sa'ada, home to the Houthi rebels. Saudi military officials have declared the first phase of the bombing campaign to be successful. U.S. federal law enforcement agents arrested two suburban Chicago men accused of trying to join ISIS overseas while also plotting attacks in the United States. As Kane Farabaugh reports from the Midwest state of Illinois.
To his sister, Monchaniqua Bates, 22-year-old Hassan Edmonds, and his cousin, 29-year-old Jonas Edmonds, were quiet introverts.
They stick to themselves. They're funny. As we would say, they're kind of weird.
But a Department of Justice investigation claims the pair wanted to support the Islamic State militant group and plotted to attack a military base in northern Illinois.
It's shocking that somebody that isn't within our own ranks would allegedly plan such deeds.
Illinois National Guard Public Affairs Director Lieutenant Colonel Brad Layton says Hassan Edmonds was a soldier assigned to Gulf Company of the 634th Brigade Support Battalion. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Joliet, Illinois.
People in Sierra Leone have been told to stay at home this weekend as authorities make another attempt to stop the Ebola epidemic that has claimed more than 3,000 lives in the country. The national lockdown announced by the government began Friday and runs through Sunday evening. During that time, health workers will go door to door to look for hidden Ebola patients and remind people how to prevent the spread of the deadly virus. Alfred Paolo Conte, who heads the country's Ebola Response Center, told reporters that health workers also aim to fight complacency. Ebola has infected an estimated 12,000 people in Sierra Leone, more than in any other country. The U.S. economy expanded at a 2.2% annual pace in October, November, and December of 2014, which is much slower than growth in the previous quarter. A government report issued Friday says lower federal spending and rising imports restrained growth. The analysis is a final version of the fourth quarter growth figures based on the most complete data. The figure surprised many economists who had predicted slightly higher growth for the last few months of the year. The report also shows the growth rate fell for all of 2014 to be around 2.4%. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Nigerians will line up at the polls across the nation Saturday to cast ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections. But what happens after that is anyone's guess, and some are fearing the worst.
That's Chris Stein reporting from Kano. Details next. Also in the news, the Kenyan government is taking dramatic new steps to secure its border with Somalia by erecting a wall designed to keep out militants. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, today, is a day of rest in Nigeria's presidential campaign. Voters go to the polls tomorrow to choose a president. Incumbent Goodluck Jonathan faces challenger Muhammadu Buhari, a former military ruler. VOA reporter Peter Cloti is in Nigeria and has been following political developments. From Abuja, he spoke to Joe Dukapua about the lack of campaigning today and the latest political rumors.
So today there will be no campaigning per the constitution. The constitution stipulates that 24 hours before the election, there should be no campaign. So no advertisement is being run by any of the political parties. And today is a day of reflection. So nobody is campaigning. The streets are pretty much empty at the moment. And at the headquarters of INEC, you could not see any political paraphernalia here. So it is pretty quiet, and there are no campaigns whatsoever across the country.
Although there's no campaigning, INEC is still pretty busy getting ready for tomorrow's election. But I understand that it's denying rumors and accusations that it's attempting to rig the election in favor of the opposition.
You are right, Joe. So much has been said about the opposition or Progressive Congress seem to be giving President Goodluck Jonathan and his People's Democratic Party a run for their money in this election coming up on Saturday. And people are speculating that it appears that INEC has come up with a plot to rig it in favor of the APC. Now, they are saying this because the PDP has been a dominant party for a very long time since Nigeria returned to constitutional rule in 1999. So with the resurgence of the APC, especially before the election was postponed from February 14 to 28 March, people have been wondering how come the APC, which is a small party with less structures on the ground, is being so competitive. So they believe, and they've been speculating, that it appears INEC will rig the vote in its favor. But the officials of INEC that I spoke with vehemently denied of any plot, and they said they've implemented measures to ensure that the election is credible, free, fair, and transparent.
So, Peter, are those accusations coming from President Jonathan's ruling party?
You cannot rightly put it that way, because the ruling party has yet to officially come out to say that. But the rumor has been circulating both in Lagos and especially here in Abuja and some parts of the country as well. And that is why INEC found it very critical to come out to debunk those rumors being peddled around.
Now, as you know, there was a recent court decision that forbade the government from deploying troops at polling stations, that it might indicate some intimidation or trying to favor one candidate. Now, I understand President Jonathan is trying to overturn that decision. What is the latest on that?
Yes, the government filed a petition in a high court in Lagos, specifically to seeking the court to set aside the ruling that prevents President Jonathan from deploying the military to provide security across the country ahead of the election and during the election as well as after the election. Now, it's been a tradition that for security purposes, military has always been deployed to provide security and to ensure that prospective voters feel safe enough to go to the polls to vote. However, the APC recently have expressed concern that in certain areas in the country, they cite the state of Ekiti, where they said military personnel were deployed to intimidate and harass their supporters, and that made the ruling party to win the election, the gubernatorial election there. So they went to court, seeking the court to prevent the government from deploying military personnel across the country to provide security, fearing that the National Army will be used in favor of the PDP to intimidate and harass voters into voting for the PDP. So that is the genesis of this whole problem. But it remains to be seen what the court will decide in Lagos today before the election tomorrow, Joe.
But I understand that the troops will be allowed at polling centers in areas where Boko Haram has been active in the Northeast?
Yes, they will be. As we know, Boko Haram has been militarily pressurized, and they have been cordon off basically in some places. The president promised that Gwazo, which is the last stronghold of Boko Haram, will be liberated today ahead of tomorrow's election. So yes, the military will be deployed in areas where Boko Haram used to control to provide adequate security. However, INEC has set up polling stations, not permanent polling stations, but ad hoc polling stations. So those who have been displaced can go there and cast their ballots during tomorrow's election, Joe.
Now, Peter, I understand there's a bit of political intrigue going on in Nigeria today, and the state security officials are concerned about this. Can you tell us what you're hearing?
I spoke with some officials of the Department of State Security, and especially the spokesperson, Marilyn Onga, who said that the Department of State Security, or as they are called, DSS, has uncovered a plot to announce the election results across all media platforms before the Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, does. Now, this is illegal and an affront to the Constitution, because the Electoral Commission, or INEC, has the sole responsibility and mandate by law to declare the results or the outcome of the election. No group of persons are allowed to announce the result. And that is what the Department of State Security want to make clear to all citizens, that when they get results from anybody saying exit poll results here and there should be disregarded, they should only get results authenticated by the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, in order to broadcast that, and that the outcome of the election can only be determined by the Electoral Commission. In this case, Professor Atai Rujiga, the chairman of the Electoral Commission, or whoever he appoints to declare the results.
And that's VOA's Peter Cloti from Abuja. He spoke to Jody Kepawa. As mentioned earlier, Nigerians will line up at polls across the nation tomorrow to cast ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections. But what happens after that is anyone's guess, and some are fearing the worst. Chris Stein reports from Kano on worries of a violent aftermath to what is widely expected to be a close vote.
When results in Nigeria's presidential election are announced, the biggest question may not be how will the winners celebrate, but how will the losers handle the news? Will supporters of opposition candidate Muhammadu Buhari and his All Progressives Congress stay calm if he loses his fourth attempt at winning the presidency? What about if voters unseat incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan and his ruling People's Democratic Party, which has controlled the presidency since 1999? What if the new voting procedures the Electoral Commission put in place don't work and people can't cast their ballots? And how about Boko Haram, the Islamist extremist group that has threatened to disrupt the vote? The northern city of Kano has borne the brunt of several Boko Haram attacks, including a suicide bomb and shooting attack at its main mosque in November. It was also the site of rioting after the 2011 elections, when Buhari supporters accused officials of rigging the vote for Mr. Jonathan. That spasm of violence left more than 800 people dead, mostly in the country's north. Civil servant Ahmed Ibrahim says he thinks the police can protect voters, but he fears partisan violence, particularly if voters heed the advice of some politicians who have encouraged people to remain at polling stations after casting ballots as a way to stop fraud.
When you vote, just let. You know what you bought. People know what they bought. And at that scene, there is no way they can rig this election. So staying there can cause a lot of problems, what I'm thinking.
A Kano police spokesman says law enforcement is shutting down roads between the states at midnight tonight and during the voting tomorrow. Housewife Hajia Ture Ibrahim says she's confident these preparations will prevent any Boko Haram attacks. Ibrahim says she's comfortable that the security preparations will protect voters from any of the unrest seen in the Northeast, where Boko Haram is particularly strong. She says the government has been speaking with young people to urge them to remain peaceful during the vote. But political violence flared up this week in the southern Niger Delta region. Voters in Rivers State have long supported Mr. Jonathan. But the 2013 defection of the state governor, Chibuike Rotimi Amaechi, to the opposition party has inflamed tensions in the state. On Thursday, gunmen tried to assassinate Amaechi as he campaigned in the state capital, Port Harcourt. His supporters accused the ruling party of being behind the attack. In recent weeks, Port Harcourt has been rocked by a series of fatal gun battles that Sofiri Job Peterside, a sociology lecturer at the University of Port Harcourt, says are politically motivated.
There are those who purchase this violence, and experience has shown that in this part of the country, those who possess and control the instruments of violence also controls the processes, the electoral processes, and eventually controls the results.
The two major presidential candidates met in the capital of Abuja on Thursday and released a joint statement, pledging to respect the outcome of the vote. Only time will tell what effect that will have on the streets of Nigeria once the polls are closed. Chris Stein for VOA News, Kano, Nigeria.
U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Linda Thomas-Greenfield left today for Nigeria. She leads an official observer delegation for Nigeria's presidential and parliamentary election. Another monitoring delegation from the U.S.-funded National Democratic Institute is being led by former Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, Johnny Carson. Other NDI monitors include former Niger Prime Minister Mahamadou Danda and the Institute's Regional Director for Africa, Christopher Fomo-Unyo. A day before voting, the Nigerian military says it has captured the northeastern town of Gwoza. A military spokesman says several insurgents have been killed and many have been captured. He describes Gwoza as the military headquarters of the Boko Haram insurgency. Boko Haram took the town in August of last year. Experts believe Boko Haram held most of the more than 200 schoolgirls in Gwoza after they were abducted from the town of Chibok. Army spokesman Mike Amari says, with help from Chad, Niger and Cameroon, about 30 towns have been liberated in Adamawa and Yobe states. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Eighteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Linda Thomas-Greenfield left today for Nigeria. She'll lead an official observer delegation for Nigeria's presidential and parliamentary elections. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Al-Shabaab militants are claiming responsibility for an attack on a major hotel in the Somali capital Mogadishu that killed at least five people. Witnesses say today's attack against the Maka al-Mukarrama Hotel began when a car bomb exploded, followed by at least three gunmen storming the building. A journalist at the scene tells VOA Somali Service that three soldiers and two civilians were killed in the initial blast. It's not immediately known if there are more casualties inside the building. Guri Haji Hassan is co-owner and manager of the hotel. He tells VOA that the gunmen entered the facility through the back door after detonating the bomb. He also says the militants are in control of the hotel. Hassan says he was refused permission to create a roadblock outside the hotel.
Music.
In Sierra Leone, health workers are going door to door to raise awareness about Ebola as that country undergoes a 3-day voluntary lockdown. The government has asked people to stay home. The head of Sierra Leone's Ebola response effort says a major goal of the voluntary confinement of the nation's 6 million people is to prevent complacency about Ebola. Alfred Paloconti says thousands of teams will knock on doors to remind people how Ebola is spread and how to prevent it. In the hot spots, the regions around the capital, and in the north, health workers will also search for Ebola cases. Meanwhile, the U.S. National Institutes of Health says two vaccines being tested in Liberia are safe. An estimated 600 volunteers recently completed trials of vaccines developed by the U.S. National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, GlaxoSmithKline Pharmaceuticals in the U.K. and the Canadian Public Health Agency. Another 1,500 volunteers are being recruited for effectiveness trials at the Redemption Hospital in Monrovia. Top U.S. health officials, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says the efficiency trial should be completed in about a year. Also, the condition of an American health worker evacuated March 13th from Sierra Leone with the Ebola virus has improved. The condition of the unidentified man has been upgraded from critical to serious. And scientists are developing an Ebola vaccine for apes that's designed to protect humans from future outbreaks. While still a number of years off, researchers say the vaccine offers a win-win solution for both species that are sickened and die of Ebola. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The handling and consumption of bushmeat, meat from wild, non-domesticated animals, is a common occurrence in Africa, particularly in the Congo Basin. It's believed meat from an ape infected with the Ebola virus first passed the deadly disease to humans in 1976. There have been more than 20 outbreaks since then. The current Ebola crisis in Western Africa has sickened and killed as many as 10,000 people since last year. It was, in all likelihood, caused by contact with infected fruit bats in urban areas with poor infrastructure. Apes and other primates can become infected when they eat fruit that's fallen onto the jungle floor, contaminated by bat droppings. In an attempt to stem future Ebola outbreaks, scientists are developing what they call a disseminating vaccine to prevent the disease in western lowland gorillas, a bushmeat source. A harmless microbe called cytomegalovirus is the vehicle for the Ebola vaccine. Almost all mammals are infected by cytomegalovirus beginning at a young age, offering the potential for wide coverage. Michael Jarvis is a virologist at Plymouth University in England who helped develop the primate vaccine, which would be delivered to wild apes by a blow dart. Jarvis and colleagues describe the strategy in the journal Vaccine.
And that's the attraction of this approach, is that you would do that for a few animals and then you'd rely upon the dissemination aspect of the virus to now do the rest of the work for you.
So far, the vaccine has been shown to work well in mice that are challenged with Ebola. Investigators are now conducting a study using rhesus macaque monkeys. Ebola kills an estimated 30% of lowland gorillas, one reason the species is on the endangered list. Jarvis says a disseminating vaccine could go a long way toward protecting the gorillas and controlling future Ebola outbreaks.
About 30% of the outbreaks, the 20 or so outbreaks that have occurred, have directly been from handling great ape carcasses. So what this will do is decrease decrease the frequency of transmissions and outbreaks into the human population in the future.
Still to be determined is how much protection the Ebola vaccine gives apes that have not been directly inoculated but have been infected with the vaccine from primates that were treated. If everything goes according to plan, Jarvis says, a vaccine shielding apes and other primates from Ebola could become available in 3 to 4 years. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Human Rights Office reports political action is building in Tanzania, Malawi, and Burundi to clamp down on the horrific trade of albino body parts. While welcoming these moves, the agency says much work and commitment will be needed to end the horror of this rapidly growing industry. Lisa Schlein reports from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights says all three countries, Tanzania, Malawi, and Burundi, have some kind of action plan underway or under consideration. It applauds in particular a newly unveiled five-point plan in Malawi, which it says is striking for its detail and adoption of new laws needed to protect people with albinism. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says political commitment to abolish the sale of albinos' body parts seems to be increasing in all three countries.
Whether that really is going to make significant difference in the number of cases and in changing the mentality that's driving this awful trade, you know, we're not there yet. At the end of the day, it's only when people stop having their limbs chopped off and stop being murdered that we can talk about positive results.
The UN Human Rights Office has received reports of more than 200 cases of attacks against people with albinism, mostly children. They include killings and mutilations from 15 countries between 2000 and 2013. It is believed the number of victims is greatly underestimated, as many attacks and killings go undocumented. This horrific trade is driven by the false belief that body parts from albinos possess magical powers capable of bringing riches. It also thrives because of the vast amounts of money to be made. For example, Colville notes, a man in Malawi was paid $6,500 for attempting to kidnap his 11-year-old niece. He says the man, who recently received a 2-year prison sentence, was one of at least 3 people involved in this operation.
You're seeing obviously a chain of people involved in this awful, hideous commerce. So who is paying these large sums of money, not very clear. But it at least in Tanzania, it does seem to get worse during election periods. So that would imply that politicians are involved in to some extent.
Tanzania is the country where most killings of albinos have taken place in recent years. General elections are set for the end of October, and this seems to have ushered in a new wave of attacks. President Jakaya Kikwete has promised to put an end to this and not to allow the attacks to escalate as they have done in previous years. In June 2013, the UN Human Rights Council passed a resolution aimed at preventing and combating discrimination and violence against people with albinism. In another move to keep this issue on the international stage, the Council on Thursday approved the appointment of an independent expert whose job will be to promote the rights of albinos and make sure they are treated as equal members of their societies. Colville says this important new mandate will help give a voice to these people and contribute to their protection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
Join host Chaka Sali and VOA's Straight Talk Africa this Saturday at 1800 UTC for special coverage of Nigeria's elections. You will get on-the-ground reports from VOA's journalists in Nigeria, in-depth discussion, and expert analysis of the most important election issues. Join us for Straight Talk Africa special Nigeria Decides right here on Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Linda Thomas-Greenfield left today for Nigeria. She'll lead an official observer delegation for Nigeria's presidential and parliamentary election. And the Kenyan government is taking dramatic new steps to secure its border with Somalia by erecting a wall designed to keep out militants. Coming up, music from South Africa. And in our feature segment, the plight of 1.5 million Nigerians who have fled their homes during 6 years of Boko Haram assault in northern Nigeria. I'm Yehi Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yahayas.
So what's on the sports menu this evening?
Well, we kick off with African football, Yahayas. Thank you.
Thank you.
In this week's friendly soccer matches, Uganda pulled off a stunning 1-0 win in Nigeria. Farouk Mia's close-range shot deflected in 9 minutes from time. The match was played in the Nigerian southern city of Uyo. Uyo is Nigeria's goalkeeper and captain Vincent Enyama's hometown. Enyama became only the second Nigerian to win 100 caps, and he was presented with a trophy before the match. He now joins Joseph Yobo on 100 caps for Nigeria. Enyama is likely to beat the record when the Super Eagles play South Africa on Sunday. The 32-year-old player is the fourth African goalkeeper to win 100 caps after three Egyptians, Esam El Hadary, Nadal Al Sayed and Ahmed Shaboy previously achieved that feat. After the match, Nigerian Football Federation president Amaju was reportedly critical of the Super Eagles squad, which was led by caretaker coach Daniel Amakachi. Meanwhile, the Zambian national team has survived facing FIFA sanctions after their government paid the former national football coach Dario Bonetti. Frenchman Bonetti, who was in charge of Chipolopolo from July 2010 to October 2011, had been owed nearly $500,000. Bonetti was sacked with 9 months left on his deal, despite qualifying for the 2012 Africa Cup of Nations. He lodged a complaint against the Zambian Football Association with FIFA, and a hearing had been set for August. Following Zimbabwe's expulsion from the 2018 World Cup qualifiers for failing to pay former coach Jose Claudini Giorgini, there were fears Zambia could face an international ban if they did not pay Bonetti. Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma.
We begin with football. Egypt beat Equatorial Guinea 2-0 in Cairo as Qatar edged Algeria 1-0 in Doha, and African champions Ivory Coast beat Angola 2-0 in friendlies played on Thursday. Elsewhere, Japan hosts Tunisia as Gambia welcome Mauritania today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Ghana plays Senegal. Comoro Islands engage Madagascar. Mauritius play Togo. Seychelles face Kenya. The Democratic Republic of Congo engage Iraq. And Morocco welcome Uruguay. On Sunday, Ivory Coast host Equatorial Guinea. Zambia play Rwanda. Tanzania host Malawi. South Africa play Nigeria. And Botswana engage Mozambique. Morocco play Djibouti in a beach soccer encounter. While in women's football, Egypt host Kenya in Cairo. In rugby, South Africa play Argentina, France and Japan in Group C action at the three-day IRB series in Hong Kong, China today, Friday. In Group D, Kenya face the United States of America, England and Wales. In cricket, Ghana play Namibia, Botswana face Kenya and Tanzania engage Uganda at the start of the ICC African 2020 Championships in Benoni, South Africa today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Botswana face Namibia, Ghana play Tanzania and Kenya engage Uganda. On Sunday, Namibia face Tanzania, Botswana challenge Uganda as Ghana encounter Kenya. In boxing, Ghanaian Emmanuel Tagoa fights Gilbert Reyes of the Philippines for the WBA International Lightweight title in Accra, Ghana today, Friday. Turning to athletics, defending champion Emily Chebet and Bedan Karoki lead Kenya's charge to retain the women's and men's team title at the IWF World Cross Country Championships in Guiyang, China tomorrow, Saturday. Ugandan World Junior 10,000-meter champion Joshua Cheptegei looks the strongest candidate to challenge the Kenyan monopoly of the junior men's crown, while the Kenyans are expected to dominate the junior women's event. The Kenyan party could also be disrupted by their perennial rivals from Ethiopia and Eritrea. The winner of the senior men's and women's races gets $30,000 each, with prize money going to the top six finishers in each event. The team prize winners share $20,000. In all, $280,000 are up for grabs for top performances.
That was Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks, Mark.
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports Show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
In athletics, Sportsimo Prague Half Marathon is on this Saturday. Among the elite runners there is Kenya's Leonard Komen, who will be competing in his second half marathon at this event. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with Komen in Prague, and here is Andy.
Talking with Leonard Komen, who's going to be running, well, the second half marathon of his career. That's the Sportsimo Prague Half Marathon this Saturday. And Leonard, you made a very good debut in the marathon a year ago in Berlin, 59 minutes 14, that's impressive going. How do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as an all-round distance runner, because you're fastest man ever at 10K? Is this all part of your portfolio of running?
Yeah, I think it's my part of performance and career. And when I start running, I feel that I want to be a man like other men who ran faster on that times, like Paul Target and others. And to my focus and vision is to climb slowly from 10K, 15 kilometers, and half marathon to go to marathon. And now I'm on a third stage, which is half marathon, and I feel that I want to do something.
That's very interesting. You talk about Paul Turgat, who had such all-round ability, 5 world cross-country titles, then breaking the world marathon record, and, of course, silver medals at 10,000 in the Olympics. Is he somebody that you really aspire to emulate, to try and achieve what he achieved in his career and, indeed, at the marathon?
Yeah, when I was young, I keep listening all the time sports, and the only name that he had his Paul Target, and that inspired me a lot. And one day I thought that why not me? I can do this. So when I was young, I started training slowly from primary school, secondary school. Now when I finish secondary school, it's where I realized that, oh, I can do it. No, the first year in 2006 is where I made my vision to run cross-country, my first time, which is I went to Japan, and to make my first time, I got a silver medal, and continue for 5 years without failing to go for world cross-country. Not yet acquire a gold medal, but I really tried. When I moved from junior to senior in 2008, I also got a silver medal. And 2009, I was number fourth. And 2010, also, I was number fourth. So I really tried to be like him, but it was difficult because at that time, I had a big champion like Pekele and others. So it was too hard for me to get position, but I really tried.
Anyone listening to just that would say, what a meticulous, careful planner you are of your career. How do you plan the next step, which people would say, well, inevitably, you've got all the talent to be a really top marathon runner?
Yeah, now, after I finished running cross-country, is where I thought that if it was difficult for me to compete on cross-country, why not I change to road races? Like him also, he moved from cross-country track and went to road races. And he did well. He made world record in half marathon and two marathon. So my focus on my training is that I want also to move to road races and make the same he did. So that's why I start with the 10K, and I'm happy that I make it to make world record and also 15 kilometers. But I was still continue doing it. That's the plan that I had, and I moved to half marathon last year. Unfortunately, I didn't, but I still have confident that I will make it.
Well, just one more question, just to look ahead at that Prague half marathon on Saturday. Is there any sense of a burden, the fact that people say, well, you're the fastest man in the field, you're expected to win, a lot of talk about you breaking the course record, which would mean going under 59 minutes. Is that a weight on your shoulders?
Yeah, I think most of my fans are waiting for me on Saturday to do something for them, and I'm not sleeping. I'm thinking a lot about that, and I hope that on Saturday I'm going to fulfill their hearts and their needs. And my plan is to make sure that I can't make them I cannot make them lose confidence on me.
Well, Leonard, we hope at least you get a little respite after this interview. Enjoy the rest, take what rest you can, and all the best for the Sportismo Prague Half Marathon on Saturday. Leonard Komen of Kenya, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Andy Edwards, reporting from Prague. Now, finally, Stephen Keshi will return to take charge of Nigeria following lengthy contractual talks, according to the Nigerian Football Federation. The 53-year-old, who initially took charge of the team in November 2011, has been offered a new two-year deal. His previous contract ran out after last year's World Cup in Brazil, where Nigeria reached the second round stage. During his first spell in charge, Keshi won the 2013 Africa Cup of Nations. Keshi won also the Nations Cup as a player with Nigeria in 1994. Despite his World Cup and Nations Cup feats, he failed to qualify Nigeria for the recent Africa Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impoga. Sunny will be back on Monday. Now back to you, Ahias.
Thank you, Douglas, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, we focus on the plight of 1.5 million Nigerians who have fled their homes during 6 years of Boko Haram assaults in northern Nigeria. And next, protecting wildlife in Kenya. But first, some music. Here is South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka with Matoki.
Yeah.
South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka with Matoki. About 1.5 million Nigerians have fled their homes during 6 years of Boko Haram assaults in northern Nigeria. Refugees have doubled the population of Yola, with more than 400,000 homeless Nigerians. The 10-year-old American University of Nigeria plays a central role in feeding the many of Yola's refugees. The president of the university, Margie Ensign, told VOA's David Arnold how the city, the church, churches and the students care for their less fortunate neighbors.
Well, our best estimate is that there are close to 400,000 internally displaced people in Yola. We know where people have fled, from which villages, and the population of those where they all left. The majority are living with us in the community, and that's what sets us apart, as far as I understand, from other crises like this. Only about 15,000 are in the government-run camps, and that's what the government takes care of in terms of food. The rest are with us in the community and living with community members. I can give you an example. One of the University of Nigeria's drivers has 50 people living with him. So the numbers are big. We are peaceful, however. Yola has remained peaceful, but the university and the Adamawa Peace Initiative that we founded 3 years ago has been taking care of, you know, hundreds of thousands of hungry people.
Are all of these people victims of the violence created by Boko Haram?
Yes, they are all people who have fled their villages because of either the threat of Boko Haram or Boko Haram has taken over their village.
And the villages you describe, are they all in Adamawa?
No, they're not all in Adamawa. They're in Borno and Yobe, the other two states that are also in a state of emergency. Mubi is in Adamawa, and that was one of the big ones that actually fell to Boko Haram in the fall. The army has taken it back, but as far as we can tell, there are not too many people that have gone back to Mubi. Adamawa State University, with 20,000 students, is in Mubi, and they're unable to open because of the damage their university sustained. So actually Monday we're beginning to take some of their seniors on my campus so that they can graduate.
And what's the enrollment of your campus?
We have about 1,500 students. We also have a primary school, which is elementary, a secondary school. So a little bit bigger when you put all of that together. And so in total we're about 3,000 people.
And the history of the school is rather short, as I understand it.
Well, we're 10 years old. We actually have a strong American connection. The man who founded the university, who was orphaned not far from the town, had American Peace Corps teachers in the 60s. And they really inspired him so much that when he went on and had made some money from his businesses, he decided to start an American-style university. So we really have an American heritage.
Can you tell me a little bit about the role the students have had in feeding the people?
Everyone at the university, faculty, staff, and students, have been involved in these food distributions. At St. Teresa's Catholic Cathedral, which is a huge cathedral, the bishop there has almost 3,000 people living on the ground, both Muslim and Christian. Everything that we do here is interfaith, and I think that message is important. But he has about 3,000 right living on the grounds of the cathedral. And then he and we take care of another 30,000 that are kind of under his care, living with his parishioners. I'm so proud of our students. Our student government president, a young man named Joseph, I think he's attended every food distribution. They're really seeing firsthand some of the challenges facing their country. And it fits with our mission. Our mission is to be a development university and to try to help solve at least the problems that we can in our communities.
What percentage of your college population is involved in the food distribution?
Gosh, I would say almost half of them have come at one time or another. We do 3 to 4 distributions a week, so there are plenty of opportunities for them to volunteer, but a very large percentage are involved. I'm not exactly sure what the future is. The elections are on March 28th. The army is beginning to gain some ground finally and take cities back. So the most hopeful scenario is that people are allowed to go home, particularly in time for the rains. this agriculture here is rain-fed, not irrigation, and most of these refugees are farmers. So it's really critical that they get home and get somewhere where they can plant food before the rain starts.
American University of Nigeria President Margie Ensign talking to VOA's David Arnold. In Laikipia, Kenya, rangers are driving game further into a 36,000-hectare conservancy to protect the animals from conflict with encroaching humans. Lenny Ruvaga went along as wildlife officials used trucks and helicopters to protect game from being killed by locals either for food or protection. He filed this report.
Deep in the heart of this conservancy in Laikipia, rangers conduct a coordinated foot patrol. Old Pejeta is East Africa's largest black rhino sanctuary. It also borders 18 human communities. To stop rising incidents of conflict between animals and the people living here, the rangers are herding game from the edges of the conservancy back into the expansive range. Samuel Matisio is part of a team coordinating this exercise using foot patrols, 4x4s, and a helicopter.
We conduct game drives in such places where, you know, the fence is not high profile enough to prevent animals from getting into the communities. And so basically we do this to drive animals from possible areas of conflict into the conservancy.
Surrounding local communities have been expanding into wildlife habitats. That means animals are displaced from their natural territory and end up looking for food in populated areas. As a result, locals lose crops, livestock, and sometimes their lives. In 2013, 106 people were killed in the country by wild animals, while 520 others were injured. The animals are often killed in retaliation. Willie Okoth commands 45 ranges at Old Pejeta, where he's served for 15 years. He says a prolonged dry period this year has intensified animal-human conflict.
At the moment, there's drought and it's quite dry. This is the reason why the animals go off the conservancy and invade farms. So we conduct game drives so as to limit the number of animals that breach the boundaries and keep them in so as to maintain good relations with locals.
The Kenyan government has an economic interest in protecting its wildlife, which attracts tourists and creates jobs. Last year, the government passed a law that compensates victims for loss of life or injury, as well as property damage caused by wildlife. But as long as animals and people live side by side, conflict will remain a fact of life. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Laikipia, Kenya.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world is changing, and so is diplomacy and development. Global challenges such as climate change, poverty, terrorism, and disease are often too expansive and complex to be met by any one government or group. Addressing such problems requires innovation, ingenuity, and collaboration across diverse sectors. In 2009, the Secretary's Office of Global Partnerships was established at the U.S. State Department to promote the development of public-private partnerships to leverage the best of public and private sector resources to create practical solutions for such challenges. The office, which has leveraged over $829 million in public and private resources since 2009, engages companies, startups, NGOs, foundations, faith-based organizations, universities, research centers, and civil society groups as full partners in the process of problem solving. In Africa, the three-year-old Liberalizing Innovation Opportunity Nations Partnership, or Lions at Africa, mobilizes the knowledge, expertise, and resources of leading public and private institutions to encourage and enhance technology and innovation by investing in capacity building for startups, providing access to capital, promoting connectivity with global markets, and raising the credibility of the startup culture. Some 2,000 entrepreneurs have participated in Lions at Africa-supported capacity-building activities. Over 80 startups were launched at Demo Africa, a signature annual event, and raised more than $10 million in capital financing to date. In 2013, five Lions innovators won opportunities to present their ideas at the main demo event in the United States High-Tech Center, Silicon Valley. Over 30 Lions won opportunities to compete in South Africa at a global pitch event for leading international investors. And 80 children are participating in pilot AfriCoder Dojo programs in Nigeria and Tanzania that provide free computer coding sessions and mentoring to young people. Many more coding clubs are planned across the continent. As with our nation's public-private partnership efforts in other parts of the world, Lions at Africa leverages the financial and in-kind resources of both the public and private sectors. It brings together leading IT companies, international development organizations, technology associations, and startup accelerators and incubators across the African continent to develop flagship programs and initiatives that deliver widespread results.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Join host Chaka Sali and VOA's Straight Talk Africa this Saturday at 1800 UTC for special coverage of Nigeria's elections. You will get on-the-ground reports from VOA's journalists in Nigeria, in-depth discussion, and expert analysis of the most important election issues. Join us for Straight Talk Africa special Nigeria Decides right here on Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.